Well, turn with me again, please, to the book of Ecclesiastes. And we're going to consider for a few minutes a section of the passage I read just now. So we're going to focus our thoughts on Ecclesiastes chapter 11, verse 9, to chapter 12, verse 1. And I'll just read that part of our passage again. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes, but know that for all these things God will bring you into judgment. Remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vanity. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. And as we consider then these three verses this evening, I would like us to do so under three headings, noticing first of all the final pleasure. The final pleasure. Let me read to you the following quotes. There is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work. I commend joy. To eat and drink and be joyful. Eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart. Let your garments be always white. Let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love. Now you might be thinking, okay, Dan, what worldly anthology of secular wisdom have you been trawling through to find those quotes? They don't sound very much like Jonathan Edwards or Martin Lloyd-Jones. They sound much more like the Reader's Digest or the fridge magnets on your neighbour's kitten, your neighbour's kitchen. Where on earth have I got these quotes from? Well, as some of you will probably recognise, they're actually from the Holy Scriptures. They're from this book of Ecclesiastes, and I could produce three or four almost identical quotes from the same source, because the author then of Ecclesiastes repeatedly presents food and drink and work and marriage as sources of pleasure, as things to be enjoyed. He does that throughout the book. And as he comes now to almost the end of the book, as he comes to chapter 11 and verse 9, he has one more happy thing to add to the list. And it's this then, it's the days of youth. Rejoice in those, he's now saying to his readers. Enjoy the days of your youth with a cheerful heart. And that's what I mean then by the final pleasure, after having already commended food and drink and work and marriage repeatedly throughout this book. Now, in the last part of it, he commends youth as equally a pleasure to be enjoyed. Youth is the final pleasure to be covered by the author in this book. Now, you might be thinking, well, it's a bit surprising that the writer of Ecclesiastes looks so favourably upon youth, upon the pleasures of youth. You might think, well, it's a rather dangerous and cavalier approach. You might rather prefer the perspective of the Apostle Paul when he warns, of course, in 2 Timothy 2:22, of the dangers of youthful passions. Surely there are many pitfalls, many snares, many temptations associated with this particular stage of life. And this breezy advice then from this writer, oh, rejoice in the days of youth, it just doesn't seem to strike perhaps the right note. But actually, when you examine the verse, Ecclesiastes 11:9 isn't as reckless as it first appears. I mean, its concluding words certainly don't beat around the bush, do they? But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. Now, we need to be clear here that the word judgment is being used in its strict and proper sense. Judgment in the Bible does not mean condemnation and punishment. Judgment means examination, which may lead to condemnation and punishment, or it may lead to vindication and reward. But judgment in the scriptures means examination. It means God's judicial scrutiny of a person's life. And the writer is saying here then that when you are finally summoned before God's judgment throne, and when he finally casts his judicial eye over your life, the days of your youth will not be excluded from that judicial review. No, the days of your youth will be included in it. So that when he says in the middle of the verse, walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes, he's obviously not being blasé there and cavalier. He's not saying when your youthful heart desires to get drunk, then that's fine, just go for it. And when your youthful eyes are full of sexual lust, that's fine, just go for it. He can't be saying that, because he also says that there's a divine judgment, a divine examination impending. Now, this writer isn't commending youthful passions any more than the Apostle Paul is. He's commending rather all the good and wholesome pleasures associated with youth. In most cases, being youthful means being physically active, able to run up mountains and spend hours at a time in the gym. Enjoy that, the writer is saying. In most cases, being youthful means being mentally alert, able to learn all sorts of interesting facts and remember them. Enjoy that, he's saying. In most cases, being youthful means being economically carefree, able to live in your parents' home, earning no money, buying no food, paying no bills. Enjoy that, he's saying. And so we could go on. In a similar vein, we could talk about the metabolism that goes with youth. Enjoy eating lots of food and not putting on much weight as a consequence. We could talk about the adaptableness that accompanies youth, coping easily with new situations and new technologies. We could talk about the novelty that's part of youth, experiencing new things all the time. And the writer is saying then, make the most of all this. Enjoy having a body that works, a mind that is fresh, and a situation in life that is largely free from responsibility. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes, he says. When your youthful heart desires to run and to explore and to climb and to jump, and to ride, go for it. When your youthful eyes want to investigate the wonders and delights of art and science, go for it, he's saying. Youth is good, the writer is saying. It's full of opportunities and possibilities. It's full of blessings and pleasures and benefits. If you are in that category, if you are youthful, and of course the writer doesn't spell out what exactly that means in terms of ages, but if that's where you are, then enjoy it, the writer is saying. Make the most of this blessing. Make the most of the food, the drink, marriage, work, all these other blessings that God freely and richly provides, and make the most of this one. This is the final pleasure that the writer covers. Enjoy youth, because youth is good and youth is a blessing from God. So that's the first thing we have in our text, the final pleasure. But then secondly this evening, the lurking problem. The lurking problem. Because as the writer then moves on into verse 10, he seems to be hinting there that this rejoicing in your youth, which he has been commending, is actually easier said than done. he seems to be hinting that enjoying to the full the pleasures of youth isn't quite as simple as it sounds. Look at what he says. Remove vexation from your heart. Now, vexation isn't exactly a word which leaps from the page with meaning and relevance. The NIV's anxiety, I think, is better. A fretfulness is how one commentator renders it. Clearly, the writer here is talking about some kind of mental unease which can dampen the joy that should be there in youth. By the way, when he then goes on in the next part of the verse to say, and put away pain from your body, sounds a little bit odd. I think he's simply reflecting a very Hebrew understanding of how human beings work. That what is going on at the emotional and psychological level will normally manifest itself somehow at the physical level. You see this in the Psalms. We've seen it ourselves in the Psalms on Sunday evenings recently. When the psalmists are laboring under conviction of sin, now that's an emotional and psychological thing, they talk about their energy being drained and their bones aching, which is a physical thing. And of course, the Hebrews were very perceptive in this. You know yourself, don't you, that when you are feeling stressed, often that will express itself, manifest itself in some kind of physical way. And so I'm saying then that the writer here is primarily talking about some kind of mental unease, but there is this bodily aspect which inevitably accompanies the mental ease. The primary focus, however, is on the mental dimension. And we need to ask the question, then, well, what's he talking about? Why is it so difficult, he seems to be suggesting? Why is there this problem? Why is there this impediment to enjoying the days of youth? Why does he have to talk about removing anxiety, removing fretfulness from your heart? Why can't those in the days of their youth just throw themselves into the good pleasures that it contains? Well, I think we can suggest two answers. First of all, the days of youth are fleeting. The days of youth are fleeting. Look at the last phrase there in verse 10. Youth and the dawn of life are vanity. Now, that word vanity in the Hebrew, it literally means a vapor or a mist. Perhaps you've been to the coast on a morning and there's been this sea mist lying there, and it's so thick and it's so real, you think, well, will we ever be able to see anything again here? It's just so prevalent, so dominant, this mist that has come down. But then, of course, in just a few seconds that mist can lift, can't it? And suddenly you can see out to the horizon. You can see along the full length of the beach, and after a few minutes you've forgotten all about it. It's just gone like that. And the writer is saying that's what youth is like. The days of youth are like a vapor. They are like a mist. They seem very substantial while they're there, but soon they fly. Soon they are gone. Now, I guess many young people probably don't reflect very often on that, the fact that it is fleeting, and perhaps others actually want it to go as fast as possible because they want to reach adult life. But I think that there can be a sense for youth, for young people, there can be a sense of this transience, the fact that it's so fleeting. You're in your mid-teens and suddenly you kind of hit a conveyor belt. You're having to make choices for GCSEs, and then you're taking GCSEs, and you're having to make choices for A-levels, and you're taking A-levels. You're having to make choices for universities, and then you're at university and having to make career choices, and suddenly you find yourself rushing through and life's getting more and more serious, it seems, and the days of kind of idle summers when you could mess around seem to be fast disappearing. And I think there can be that sense of it being fleeting, which then is the anxiety, the vexation, the fretfulness that the writer's alluding to, that dampens the joy. For some young people at least, that sense that it's moving fast, soon life is going to be much more serious and much more full of responsibilities, that kind of prevents them from fully enjoying the experience of youth itself. And of course, we can broaden this out beyond youth, can't we? And I guess all of life's legitimate pleasures can be dampened by this sense they are so fleeting. Whether it's a holiday that you're on, whether it's a cup of coffee that you're drinking in Starbucks, whether it's the parenting of young children, whatever it might be, there can be that nagging sense, well, soon this is going to be gone, soon this is going to be over. And that can then dampen the pleasure, dampen the joy that you would otherwise experience. And so I think that's one reason for this hint of anxiety and fretfulness, that the days of youth are fleeting. But then the second reason, the days of youth can't bear the weight of our pleasure seeking. The days of youth can't bear the weight of our pleasure seeking. What I mean is this, that you can grasp with both hands all the pleasures of youth that we've just been talking about, the physical agility and strength and energy, the mental freshness and alertness and alacrity and all the rest of it. You can grasp those with both hands. You can throw yourself into all the good things that are part of youth, and yet you will find that they don't satisfy fully. They won't fully scratch the itch. They won't fully impart fulfillment and satisfaction. Because the fact is, we have a desire for pleasure in our hearts that is so strong that the pleasures of youth, those things we've mentioned just now, they cannot bear the weight of those desires. They will crack under them. See, this is a theme of Ecclesiastes that applies not just to youth, it applies to money. Go back to chapter 5 and verse 10, and we read there, "He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income." So here's someone who's just really going down the money route and really trying to satisfy all his inner desires with money, and he gets money, but it doesn't scratch the itch. It doesn't bring the satisfaction he was looking for. Or further back in chapter 2, and verses 10 and 11, we read there the writer saying, "Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered that all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind." So he says, I denied my heart no pleasure. I just grasped with both hands every possible source of pleasure. And yet, still I found that it was a striving after wind. It couldn't bear the weight of my pleasure-seeking impulses. And again, we shall always find that if there's anything that we are looking to fulfill the desires that are there in our hearts, might be something very good. It might be a marriage, it might be children, it might be a Christian ministry. But if we are looking to that thing to fulfill the deepest desires in our hearts, to give us ultimate pleasure, that thing will not be able to bear the weight of our pleasure seeking, and it will crumble and crack and break beneath it. And that then, I think, is the second reason why this Rejoicing in the days of your youth is easier said than done. It sounds easy enough. Oh, there are all these good things that are associated with youth. Rejoice in them, enjoy them. But there's this lurking sense that it's all so fleeting, it's going so fast. And then there's this sheer inability of youth, if pursued as something that's going to satisfy my desires, there is its inability to do that. So the final pleasure and the lurking problem. But then thirdly and finally this evening, the missing piece. The missing piece. Now you might be thinking, well, Ecclesiastes then seems a bit of a frustrating and unsatisfactory book. It's telling us in all these different places to enjoy food, enjoy drink, enjoy work, enjoy marriage, enjoy youth. But then it's also saying that we can't really do that. That seems a bit of a paradox, a contradiction at the heart of the book. But of course, actually, it doesn't say that we can't enjoy those things. It's hinting that it's not straightforward. It's easier said than done. But it's not saying that we can't enjoy these blessings that it tells us to enjoy. And remember that verse 10 is actually an instruction. It's remove anxiety from your heart. Remove this fretfulness. So that suggests that it's possible to get beyond this anxiety, beyond this fretfulness. It is possible to truly and properly enjoy these blessings that God has given us. Well, how then? How is that possible? How is it possible to get beyond those two problems that we considered a moment ago? Well, the missing piece, of course, is in chapter 12 and verse 1. And I've called it the missing piece not just because I wanted another P for my sermon headings, but because it is very much the missing piece. It goes, doesn't it, with verse 9. Unfortunately, because of the chapter break, perhaps we often miss that. But we have the repeated phrase, in the days of your youth. So verse 9, rejoice in your youth, let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. And then here in chapter 12, verse 1, remember your Creator in the days of your youth. In other words, these are two things which go together. These are two things which complement each other. They belong together. It's while remembering your Creator that you enjoy the days of your youth. It's not just enjoying the days of your youth. It's enjoying the days of your youth in tandem with remembering your Creator. Which raises the question then, well, how does remembering God help in all of this? How does then having God in the equation, how does being mindful of God, how does that help you to enjoy the days of your youth? How can someone who is conscious of God enjoy their youth more than somebody who is not? How does being mindful of God circumvent those two problems that I mentioned a moment ago? Well, this is how. Number one, it no longer matters that the days of youth are fleeting. When you're remembering God, when you've got God in the picture, it no longer matters that the days of youth are fleeting. I think it's very significant that the writer refers to God here as your Creator. Now, if you're searching through the book of Ecclesiastes for a clear and precisely articulated hope of the resurrection and the new creation to come, then I'm afraid you're going to be disappointed. You won't find the equivalent of 1 Corinthians 15 in the book of Ecclesiastes. And in fact, on the face of things, you seem to find on virtually every page the opposite. You seem to find an obsession with death, and death presented as something really very final indeed. But I think that, although that is the impression you may get, I think if you are willing to really grapple with Ecclesiastes, there are hints of an awareness of something beyond death. Hints of an awareness of another world, an age to come. You see, why is it that the days of youth, and indeed all our earthly pleasures, why is it that they are so fleeting? According to the author of Ecclesiastes, why is it? Why is this the case? Why are these good things so tantalizing? We enjoy them just for such a brief period and then they're gone. Why is that the case? Is it that that is how God has designed the universe? Has God designed the universe in such a way that the best things in it are very, very fleeting? And they're here 1 minute and they're gone the next. Well, the writer's answer is no. I mean, I read earlier on the next part of chapter 12, didn't I? Where he expands on this matter of the transience, the fleeting nature of youth and indeed of life in general, and the way in which life is hurtling towards death, toward the moment when the silver cord is snapped, the golden bowl is broken, and so on. But there's a very, very important little touch in that passage. It's right at the end, in verse 7, where he's describing death. And this is how he describes it. And the dust returns to the earth as it was. Now, he hasn't made that up, has he, that line? The writer is virtually quoting there from the Old Testament. He's quoting, of course, from the book of Genesis. And he's quoting from Genesis chapter 3, where the fall takes place, where sin enters the world. As a consequence of which, God pronounces several judgments, one of which is physical death, the dust, going back to the dust. In other words, this writer is shown an awareness there that this unsatisfactory transience of things isn't original. It wasn't part of God's original creation design. It was something that was subsequently imposed because of a crisis that took place, because of man's rebellion, man's disobedience. In fact, you see this elsewhere in Ecclesiastes. There's a crucial text, chapter 7, verse 29, where he says, "See, this alone I found, that God made man upright." Now remember, Ecclesiastes is a book in which the writer explores so vividly and graphically man's corruption, how depraved man is. But here he's saying that this isn't original. God made man upright, and they have sought out many schemes. They have gone astray. So the writer shows an awareness then throughout this book that all the problems that he exposes so relentlessly in this book, including the transience of youth and all our other pleasures, all those problems are not original to this creation. Now that might not seem a big deal to you, but that was a big deal in the intellectual context in which this writer was penning these words. Nobody else in the ancient Near East had that kind of worldview. No one else outside of Israel. And of course, it's a big deal, actually, in the intellectual context that we inhabit today, isn't it? Nobody around us believes that there was once a period in history when all the problems of decay weren't here, when the world was perfect and worked perfectly, and that actually all the problems around us today have been imposed subsequently. Nobody else believes that. Everybody else believes that it's just part of the nature of things. It's intrinsic, it's essential in how the universe is. It has to be like this. It's the way it's always been, the way it inevitably has to be. And the writers say, no, it's not. It wasn't like this originally. And surely then implicit within that is the possibility that it doesn't always have to be like this in the future. that the God who created this world perfect could potentially recreate this world perfect. And of course, the writer would not have been able to see any more than those little hints. He would not have been able to spell out how that might become possible through God sending his Son into this world and his Son bearing sin in his body on the cross of Calvary and then dying and rising from the dead as the first fruits of a new creation. He could not have foreseen any of that. But there's at least this possibility that if God created everything good, he can recreate everything good. And I think that's the point then here, that if you've got God in the picture, got God in the equation, God as the creator, the only one who can sort out this mess. Remember, he says earlier on, who can straighten what God has made crooked? And of course, only God can. If your belief is in this creator who created things good and potentially can recreate things good, then the transience of youth ceases to be such a depressing matter. And the transience of all our pleasures ceases to be such a depressing matter. Because as they pass by so quickly, we can look forward to a day when God is going to recreate the world and they won't be transient anymore. And the world will be a beautiful place again. And youthfulness will, all the blessings of youthfulness, will characterize everybody eternally, everlastingly. And nothing that is good will be transient. That's our wonderful hope, isn't it, as believers tonight? A hope that through the work of Jesus Christ, I'm not talking about hope in the worldly sense of that word, hope in the sense of a sure and certain expectation. Our hope is that because of the death and resurrection of Jesus, the Creator is going to recreate. And all the good things in that new creation will be permanent and fixed, never ever to be spoiled. And so, with that in mind, we can enjoy the transient pleasures of this life. Because we know that whatever is soon going to be taken away in this life will be given back and a million times more in the new creation. So when God is in the picture, it no longer matters that the days of youth are fleeting. And then secondly, the days of youth no longer need to bear the weight of our pleasure seeking. The days of youth no longer need to bear the weight of our pleasure seeking. Just think, finally, as we close, of this word remember. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. Now, it's a word that we often use in very bland ways, isn't it? But in the Hebrew Bible, the word remember was a strong word. Let me point you to a text which really brings this out quite graphically. It's Psalm 137, a psalm I suspect we're probably not overly familiar with. It's a psalm of exile. This is the Lord's people having been exiled to Babylon, and they are lamenting the indignities of this exile, and they are looking back so wistfully to Jerusalem, how they would love to be in Jerusalem. And look at what we read in verses 4 to 6. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? And then this resolve not to forget Jerusalem. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, this is our home city back there in Israel. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill. Let my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, same Hebrew word, remember. And then he kind of expands on what he means by remembering. If I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy. See how remember there is a synonym for setting something above my highest joy. That's how strong the word is in the Hebrew language. In other words, When the writer here tells us to remember our Creator in the days of your youth, you're not just saying give him a passing thought. He's saying set your Creator above your highest joy. Whatever is your, whatever other pleasures you enjoy, set God far, far above them as your supreme pleasure, as your supreme joy, as the source of your greatest satisfaction and delight. And he's saying then that when you're doing that, when you're making God your supreme pleasure, then suddenly all those urges in your heart that can't be satisfied on money and can't be satisfied on food and drink and can't be satisfied on youth and all its blessings, all those urges will be satisfied in God, because it was for him that those urges were made. We are made for God. Our pleasure-seeking impulses, our impulses that can only be fulfilled in God. And when we are remembering him, when we are setting him as our highest joy, then those urges, those desires are filled. And then you see, you can enjoy youth, because you're not making an end in itself. You're not making it the thing that you are resting all the desires of your heart upon, but just as a gift from the God whom you are resting all the desires of your heart upon. And that's, I think, really the great message of Ecclesiastes. How can he be always commending these pleasures, food and drink and marriage and work and so on? Because when God is our supreme pleasure, then we can enjoy those pleasures properly, not as ends in themselves, not as gods, but as the gifts of the God whom we love more than his gifts. And so I want to ask you this evening, if you are a young person, are you rejoicing in all the benefits and all the good things that are part of this stage in life, which you can only really do if God is in the picture, if you're making him your highest pleasure, if you're desiring him more than anything else? Suddenly when you do that, then you can enjoy all the pleasures that he gives you, because they're in their right proportion, they're in their right place, they fit in properly. You're not trying to worship them, which will only end in disappointment. Are you doing that? Are you worshipping God and enjoying God's gifts? If you're an older person, are you doing that? Because for all of us, there are good things in life that we enjoy. Pleasures that are from God. Well, are you worshipping God and enjoying his gifts? Finding your truest satisfaction in him, but receiving with gratitude the good things that he has given you. Are you doing that? Or are you in this muddle of running around frantically, trying to find satisfaction in this thing, finding it doesn't work, and then in this thing, finding that doesn't work, then in this thing, finding that doesn't work? You will be on that quest for the rest of your life if you don't bow the knee to God, your Maker. You'll never find satisfaction anywhere. And you will finally have to stand before the God whom you've ignored. In a very solemn context indeed. Now tonight, make sure that you are bowing before God, worshipping him, and then you can properly and gratefully enjoy all his gifts. Amen. Let's close singing the doxology hymn 632, How good is the God we adore, our faithful, unchangeable friend.